my name is Michelle Fine. I'm a teacher at the Graduate Center, and it's really a pleasure to be with you all on this National Day of Action. Was anybody in the cafeteria this afternoon? So CUNY, the Occupy CUNY student group, facilitated a quite amazing performance for today's National Day of Action. One of the things they did was they came to each of our tables with a CUNY menu. They also distributed kazoos. And the CUNY menu says CUNY, Matthew Goldstein Proprietor. He's the chancellor. Thursday specials. You could order one of five meals. A Democratic University. Our signature dish, crafted and served by proprietor Matthew Goldstein and appointed board of trustees, baked in spin and topped with a light dusting of faculty and student input, goes on to meaningful academic employment, the right to peaceful protest, a safe and secure learning environment, and affordable education. This delicacy is a favorite of the legislators, corporate partners, and senior administrators. It was a remarkable performance by our students, where one of them dressed up as Kroll Company. People know what Kroll is. It's a security firm that has been hired, actually, by CUNY to assess both the videotapes and the testimony from the attack on our students by NYPD and CUNY police at Baruch, but Kroll is William Bratton's organization, the very same organization that has submitted the report to the University of California, Davis, exploitation and attack on students. So there is a fight on here at CUNY, as there is all over the world, and this seminar is very much a part of that fight. It sits at the intersection of intellectual and political struggle, and we try to bring together allies who are writers and activists and scholars and photographers and performers and domestic workers and domestic worker organizers to speak to the bloody intersections these days of immigration, the carceral state, and race. This is our third or fourth, depending on how you count, seminar in the police series. And at every seminar, what we try to do is bring together an analysis of the kind of structural intersections of policing and other major institutions. The first session looked at policing and public education, the massive presence of police inside public high schools in We looked at California, but we could have looked at New York. The second looked at the intersection of policing and domestic violence by reconsidering the 10-year anniversary of critical resistance and insight. And this session takes us into the intersect with immigration. And we are really delighted by the panelists that we brought together. Just this morning, I live in New Jersey. Chris Christie, my governor, announced that he was very angry at Ray Pelley for his treatment of the Muslim community, not because of what he did to the Muslim community, but because he didn't tell law enforcement in New Jersey what he was doing to the Muslim community. Yesterday, friends of mine called from Tucson to remind us that people all over Tucson are standing on street corners and in parks, reading aloud books that have been banned from the public schools, including Paulo Freire, including La Raza, including Rethinking Columbus by Bill Bigelow, a pretty vanilla but fabulous rewriting of American history. And so these questions and concerns are up and about us, but we have a panel that will take us through scholarship, through politics, and through performance to understand the landscape of the immigration, mass incarceration, and racial debates. As I said, our panel draws from writers, lawyers, photographers, and historians, all who are dedicated to document the assault, but more important, or as important, all who are dedicated to help us understand what it means to fight back and what it means to resist. So here's our plan. I am going to do a very brief hello and thank you. Each of our panelists will present 3 to 5 minutes on their work and their organization, and then we're going to go back again through to talk about the intersect of immigration, the carceral state, and race. Okay? Good? All right, we're going to begin with May Nye, who's a professor of history and the Lung family professor of... Can you ask people like myself to talk slower because we are also translating? So why don't I start and model what a person might do when they receive such an invitation. Okay. So May is on the faculty of Columbia University. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens, and the Making of Modern America in 2004. The Lucky Ones, One Family, and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America in 2010. She's held fellowships at Radcliffe, the Guggenheim Foundation Institute for Advanced Study. And she was, before she was an historian, she was a labor union organizer and educator in New York City for District 65, the UWA. After May, we're going to hear from Kenyon Farrow, who's a writer and an activist based in New York City. Kenyon is the former director of Queers for Economic Justice, Michelle Billy's chair. I knew your name. Kenyon's the co-editor of the anthology Letters from Young Activists, Today's Rebels Speak Out, and the forthcoming Stand Up, The Shifting Politics of Racial Uplift, South End Press. He's co-edited a report on the Tea Party and LGBT politics with the Political Research Associates and an upcoming journal issue of the journal Feminist and Scholar. His articles can be found on Huffington Post, American Prospect, Color Lines, Black Commentator, and his work can be found at his website, www.kenyonfarrow.com. Kenyon will be followed by Lillian Juarez, who is being translated by Emma Moreno. And Lillian is an organizer on the Workplace Project and coordinates the House Cleaning Cooperative for Unity House Cleaners. She originally came to the organization as a member and is a founding member of the cooperative. Bienvenidos. After Lillian speaks, we're going to hear from Pooja Jahai. Yes?
Okay.
Oh, well. Next time I'm going to get this really right. She's been working at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project since November 2005. At the Law Project, she represents low-income and or people of color who identify as transgender, intersex, and gender nonconforming people, representing them in the areas of immigration, appropriate identification, attaining benefits, Medicaid, name changes, and discrimination. Pooja has extensive experience in legal organizing. She wrote the criminal appeals for the Fourth Circuit. She's been involved in police brutality issues, prison industrial complex issues, attaining wages for farm workers in Florida. She co-authored Unraveling Injustice, Race and Class Impact of Medicaid Exclusions of Transition-Related Healthcare for Transgender People. And she wrote The Role of Lawyers in Trans Liberation, Building a Transformative Movement for Social Change. All of these people have done lots more, and if we had all night, I could tell you all about it. Fifth, we'll hear from Mizui Azeki. Help me.
Mizui Azeki.
Not bad. I'm getting closer. A social justice organizer and photographer based in New York, Mizui has worked on issues of exterior and interior immigration enforcement in Los Angeles, in Arizona, and New York over the past 15 years. She works at the Immigrant Defense Project, where she fights against growing collaboration between police and immigration. Her photographs have appeared in many publications, including Dying to Live, A Story of U.S. Immigration in an Age of Global Apartheid by Joseph Nevins. and in journals and newspapers, including the American Quarterly, Color Lines, the LA Weekly, and The Nation. Sounds good? Take it away. So each of you will present yourself for a few minutes, and then we'll go back through. So we're going to start with May.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me tonight, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's a real pleasure to come downtown to the Graduate Center. I teach history, and I work on immigration history, and specifically on the history of illegal immigration and the nature of restrictive immigration laws. As Michelle mentioned before, I went back to school to study history. I had another life as a union educator and organizer, and I worked a lot with immigrant workers here in New York City, both Asian and Latino workers, many of them in the garment industry. And so it really, so a lot of my research, I think, stems from my own experience working with immigrant workers here in the city. And when I took up the task of trying to understand the history of illegal immigration, I'll just say a little bit. I guess what I just want to say is that what motivated me was I thought it was important to try to understand illegality as something other than some kind of innate characteristic of the immigrant, right? But rather as a legal and increasingly criminalized status that is created through the law itself, right? And to try to separate in our own thinking, right, the association of illegality with somehow the personage of immigrants. So in a way, it was a way to think about restoring the humanity to immigrants and to immigrants without papers, but also to understand how a whole regime of legal, a whole legal apparatus arose in the United States that then has led us, you know, by our own time to associate immigrants and certain kinds of immigrants, certain immigrants from certain racial backgrounds as quintessentially illegal, right? So that people can just say, oh, they're illegal, as though that's the sum total of their persons. So I'll stop there, and then we can talk more later.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you. To think of how I come at this issue, I think first and foremost, just through, you know, my kind of lived life, you know, as a Black gay man growing up in projects in Cleveland, Ohio, and understanding in a very personal level the kind of impact of prison and policing, and at, you know, I'm 37, so, you know, my kind of youth was the real height of the, you know, kind of war on drugs in the 80s, and kind of watching the impact of feeling the impact of what that meant, right, in terms of just massive kind of amounts of police in the neighborhood, people getting shot by police on a pretty regular basis, my own friends and family members being locked up periodically, so on and so forth. I think I'll say these kind of three main points that I think about in terms of this conversation, or that my work is sort of informed by as a writer and activist and what have you. So one, looking at, I would say broadly, my kind of political framework is like the kind of constancy of anti-Black racism, and not just in the U.S., globally, right, at this point. In so much as it, regardless of what else is going on in terms of kind of immigration to in and out of the U.S. of other racial groups, that kind of remains a constant kind of project in the U.S. So that, like, these, you know, kind of declarations that we often hear about the sort of new criminal, the new target, the new this, that, and whatever, which a lot of the kind of immigration politics often kind of further, like, actually don't change for Black people, right? So, like, you know, so I come with some level of concern about a way that a lot of the kind of concern and advocacy around immigration gets kind of constructed. That's number one. Number two, kind of impact on what I would call like a situation that black people find ourselves in both like being kind of constantly moved and displaced throughout U.S. history as another kind of constancy, and at the same time also having our like movement also restricted and controlled, right? Either through the kind of prison apparatus or through, you know, just like actual forms of segregation that still occur. And then third, a lot of my work has also been as in HIV prevention kind of advocacy and policy work. I currently work for Housing Works as a communications manager for advocacy. And a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last 10 years has really been looking at massive imprisonment itself as a driver of the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. among black people, and I can talk later about how that actually looks, to the exclusion that actually the questions of behavior and risk behavior actually don't matter, or matter far less than what the impact of massive imprisonment and the kind of segregation that still happens have meant to drive the epidemic. That felt like that was my shut up.
That was so not directed at you.
But I was wrapping up anyway, so I'm good.
That's an unfortunate coincidence.
Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
Como dije en mi presentación, yo trabajo con el Centro de Derechos Laborales en Long Island.
Good evening. As I said in my presentation, I work with the Center for Immigrant Rights or Labor Rights in Long Island.
Actualmente soy organizadora en el centro, pero quiero decirles que yo llegué al centro buscando educación laboral porque estaba siendo explotada en mi trabajo, donde trabajaba como trabajadora del hogar, viviendo en el lugar de trabajo.
I'm right now an organizer in the center, but I want to let you know that I came to the center looking for education on labor laws because I was being exploited in my work as a live-in domestic worker.
Trabajaba largas jornadas por un bajo salario y la empleadora me había prometido patrocinarme para poder legalizar mi estatus en este país.
I was working long hours for a very low salary, and my employer had promised to sponsor me to get my papers in this country.
Después de 7 años de trabajar con ellos y dejar a mis hijos solos en un apartamento, porque yo emigré con mis hijos huyendo de una guerra civil en El Salvador.
After 7 years, leaving my children in an apartment by themselves because I immigrated with my children because we were fleeing from a civil war in our country, El Salvador.
Me dijeron que no podían patrocinarme porque no querían tener problemas con el gobierno porque nunca me habían declarado como su trabajadora, nunca habían pagado impuestos.
I was told that they couldn't sponsor me because they didn't want to have any problems with the law because they had never declared that they hadn't paid any taxes and had never declared anything on that.
Decidí salir de ahí y comenzar a luchar para que todas las trabajadoras como yo minimizar esa explotación, que nos educáramos. Y es así como trabajamos en el Centro de Derechos Laborales con las trabajadoras del hogar y con los jornaleros.
I decided to leave that work and to start fighting for all these workers so that we could use education to minimize the exploitation that was going on and that's what we do now in the Center for Labor Rights and working with domestic workers and also day workers.
Nos enfocamos en ellos para mejorar su calidad de vida porque son es la industria más desprotegida. Sin embargo, atendemos a todas las industrias en el centro.
We focus ourselves on these groups to better their quality of life because they're the most unprotected industries, but we do work with all industries in the city.
Y enfocados también en recuperar salario, porque eso ha aumentado mucho últimamente el robo de salarios. Y lo están haciendo en todos los niveles, aún en las factorías que están pues formalmente establecidos. Imagínense lo que les pasa a los jornaleros que no saben ni quién los recoge en una esquina.
We're also trying to recuperate wages, and this has really increased a lot lately in all sectors, including factories. And, you know, if this is happening in formally organized factories, imagine for day laborers who are picked up by someone they don't even know.
Y es así como desarrollamos liderazgo con las trabajadoras. Tenemos una cooperativa de limpieza de casas donde las trabajadoras tienen salarios dignos.
So this is how we work to develop leadership with the workers, and we've developed a cooperative with the house cleaners where they receive fair wages.
Y nos sentimos orgullosas como mujeres trabajadoras en la cooperativa de también ser miembros fundadoras de la Alianza Nacional de Trabajadoras del Hogar, porque así estamos trabajando a nivel de todos los Estados Unidos para educar a todas las trabajadoras.
And we are proud of also being founding members as part of this cooperative of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. So now we're educating all of the United States on these issues.
Y trabajamos definitivamente contra políticas migratorias, ¿verdad?, que nos perjudican. Decimos no a esas comunidades seguras. Nos alegramos cuando dijeron vamos a tener comunidades seguras. Creíamos que ya no íbamos a ser maltratados por la policía, pero pues es todo lo contrario.
And we are also working against some of these immigration policies. For example, we said no against secure communities at first. We thought, great, we're going to have more secure communities and we're going to be treated poorly by the police, but it's actually exactly the opposite.
Y gracias por su comprensión con la traslación. Yo me he dedicado mucho a trabajar muchas horas y se me es bien difícil el idioma, pero estamos tratando de superar eso. Pero es difícil. Lo leo, pero hablarlo me es difícil.
And thank you for your understanding with the translation. I've, you know, dedicated a lot of my hours to working hard, and this language has just really been hard for me, but we're trying to, you know, do better. I can read pretty well, but it's really hard for me to speak.
Gracias. Muchas gracias. Hi, I'm Pooja. I'm an attorney at the Sonia Rivera Law Project, which is a nonprofit organization based here in New York City. And we represent people who are transgender, gender nonconforming, or intersex, and also either low-income or people of color, and really most people we work with are all of those things. And so I do all those things that are listed in my bio, which are really a long list, and I was thinking about how I need to edit that, or maybe look at it at some point. But also, I just wanted to say that we... because we're one of the only organizations that provides free legal services for trans people, we get such a range of phone calls from all over the country, all over the state, all over the world, asking for legal services in a whole bunch of different areas. And so we're always sort of trying to streamline the work that we do so that we can help folks who are the most vulnerable and not able to access services, and then also deepen our own abilities to be able to do practice effectively, right, in the areas that are most crucial, and then part of that is thinking about where there are poverty lawyers who are practicing like really well in specific fields where we can build some level of expertise so people are trans-affirming in their services that they provide. And so lately we've been thinking through those issues a really lot and just sort of like reassessing and reassessing based on who comes through our doors and what issues are most pressing. And so at the moment we have an immigrant justice project, a prison justice or injustice project, which is also sort of like interfaces with the criminal punishment system generally. And then our third one is access to healthcare and wellness project, which is I like to call the liberation and gender self-determination project, but that's just like a work in progress. sort of the oh, I'll take your case. It sounds like you really need help. Not really. No, it's all about. And then, we come to this work with the belief that knowing the law doesn't create meaningful, sustainable social change, right? But instead, is a tool that people really need to access to survive. And so, we provide free legal services in these areas that are really crucial and vital to people's survival and ability to self-identify their gender identity, but also so that people are able to participate more fully in a broader movement for social justice. So we also have an organizing component to the project, which we call the movement building team, but it does basically like base building and campaign organizing and links the issues that we're seeing in legal service world to organizing and building further world, and stop there.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you for having me here. My name is Mizue, and as Michelle said, I am a photographer and an organizer, mostly an organizer. And I have been working on issues related to kind of policing of the U.S.-Mexico border and then also interior policing of non-citizens in this country over probably since the early 90s. And I just, at a short period of time, a lot has changed, right, as we know. You know, we've gone from a borderlands where maybe there was less than a dozen miles of fencing to over 600, you know, an incredibly huge apparatus of police along the U.S.-Mexico border of, you know, tens of thousands. I can't remember the number, sorry. I think it's 20,000 Border Patrol agents from, you know, maybe less than 1,000. And then also we live in an era of mass deportation, right? So over the past 10 years, this country has deported more people than it has in the century preceding it. And it's an incredible moment to try to fight back where, you know, where I work is at the intersection of the criminal justice system and the immigration system. So you all are familiar with, obviously, the legacy, the history, the decades of, you know, over-policing, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, all that stuff now merging with an immigration system in which people have very little rights to fight back. Right, and so as limited as the rights are that people face on the streets with the police and the courts and the jails, once you get into the immigration system, you basically have no right to government paid counsel. You know, in many cases, for almost any conviction for any drug offense, you're subject to mandatory deportation, right, and mandatory detention. And so this is a system with very little judicial review, and one. You know, and imagine in every period when you're trying to fight for the rights of the targeted population, whether it's the Chinese during the Chinese Exclusion Act or whatever, I think, you know, being in the moment of fighting for the rights of the so-called criminal alien, when there is so much agreement across the political spectrum, and then just, as I mentioned, the decades of getting us where we are, we face tremendous challenges. So I'm glad to be here with you tonight and kind of talk that stuff through. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So that's our panel. So the task we want you to help us with is to take a few minutes, each of you, to really identify, help us understand the landscape of issues that are littered at the intersect of immigration, migration, mass incarceration, prison industrial complex, and race. And both the kind of landscape of the assault, but where are the opportunities for a fight back?
Right, so we can go in the very same order.
Okay, all right, that was my my
job is to give you some of the historical background. And I guess what I want to say is that what we're witnessing today, in terms of what Mitsui was just sharing with us, while certainly the scale is really increased enormously in recent years, the phenomenon itself is not new at all. And it goes back almost 100 years, you could say more than 100 years. And so what I want to talk a little bit about is how the concept of illegality with regard to immigration came about, and what constitutes it, right? And how it is, and what does it have that's similar and different than the policing and incarceration of other populations, right? Because there are many similarities, but there are also some important differences. So the most important difference is, which is also a clue to a similarity, the most important difference is that immigrants, and this is something stating the obvious, are not citizens, okay? Now, in the United States, under the 14th Amendment, rights under the Constitution are not limited to citizens. Right, the 14th Amendment talks of persons, not citizens. But the concept of persons is an idea that suggests that an immigrant is a potential citizen. Right, an immigrant is somebody who comes from another country, does not have the same rights entirely as a citizen, but is a potential citizen, and in our idealized view of what America is a future citizen. Right. Now that narrative has its own problems, but I will just say here that the immigrant that comes without documents, the immigrant who comes without authorization, is not in that picture, because that person cannot become a citizen, right? They have to find some way to become a legal alien first before they could even contemplate the possibility of citizenship. So the undocumented alien is not entirely without rights, right, as a person, but they're vastly reduced rights, and basically they are placed outside of any possibility of entering the polity, right? So where that's similar, I think, to the question of mass incarceration and the carceral state vis-a-vis what we would call native minorities or African Americans, is that that is a move which is to remove also people from the polity, right, through the disenfranchisement of felons, right, and the removal of people from the public sphere is a similar kind of move, right? To remove people from rights, right? It's a different mechanism, but the result, you could say, is the same. So the problem with the illegal alien, and I say that not as a... I mean, I know that term has a lot of negative concepts, but as a legal term, that is a person who can never access rights, right, under the Constitution. And especially they don't have rights this is what was coming up earlier, they do not have rights with regard to immigration matters, right? So so ironically, the undocumented alien would have constitutional rights in a criminal trial, but after that trial, they would be deported without any rights, because that's a different domain, right? So we have a kind of set of rights that people enjoy by their mere presence in the country, and then there's a set of rights or lack of rights in the immigration domain, which is vastly, vastly diminished, right? And the problem with being an immigrant is that people are kind of straddling those two worlds. So the key concept here, I think, that's important for us to understand is a concept of national sovereignty and territoriality. And this is what's different from the question of citizenship. The question of citizenship is a question that presumes a membership inside the nation, right, inside the community, right? Now, it could be a second-class citizenship. It could be a citizenship that's vitiated through various means. It could be a citizenship that's actually taken away through disenfranchisement. But it's a question of membership, right? The alien is not a member, right? And the concept of sovereignty and territoriality is important because it's in this idea that the state has decided that it has absolute authority, right? Many things are subject to what the courts will say, but in the matter of immigration, immigration is considered to be in the same bundle of issues as war, conducting war, signing treaties with foreign nations, right? It's considered incident of the nation's sovereign affairs, right? How it deals with the outside. And in that function, its authority is absolute, right? So it's an extreme form of authority because it's not subject to any kind of democratic contestation or negotiation. So this means that the policing of the borders of the country becomes basically it's the same as the function of protecting the country from an invading army, right? So in our law, policing the borders from immigrants is the same, legally speaking, as policing the borders from an invading army. And you hear that in the discourse, right, in terms of invasion, hordes, you know, you see a lot of this in the rhetoric about immigration that likens them to foreign armies. So once you have this elevation of territoriality and policing the borders as primary, two things happen. First of all, the state not only has to police the borders, it has to police the entire interior of the country, right? Because it's not just a question of keeping people out, but we all know that you can't keep everybody out, even with all the fencing and equipment. So it becomes a question of policing the entire interior of the country. The second problem that comes up is, well, how do you know? How do you know that this person is an alien and not a native citizen or a naturalized citizen? And how do you know, even if you knew they were an immigrant, how would you know that they were here without authorization? Right? And this is where the whole problem of profiling and racism, I think, comes into the picture. So you have an assumption in the Southwest in particular, but through many parts of the country, that anybody who looks Latino is an alien, which is not true. Right? I mean, most people of Latino descent actually are born in this country, and 30% of the foreign-born are naturalized citizens. Okay? But there is a kind of racial profiling and assumption that you see a Latino, that's an immigrant and probably an illegal immigrant. So I think where this has tremendous implications for us is that it creates a situation where the enforcement of immigration policy, which is an enforcement of territoriality, becomes a way of basically policing throughout the entire interior of the country. It's not just a question of the border. It's a question of interior surveillance and policing. And it's something that at the end, you know, that works itself through a process where it becomes a question of racial differentiation. You know, we think that there are more Mexican illegals than any other group, and that probably is true, although we don't round up Polish people and count them as undocumented, right? So even the statistics that we have are a creation of our own choices of what communities we choose to surveil and police. So I will stop there, and I look forward to other people's.
Sure. I guess I should probably start with also, I guess, maybe naming a few kind of assumptions that I kind of operate under. So, and I'll just say, there's a quote from James Baldwin, I think it's in No Name in the Street, where he says that justice in America is a legal means of administering injustice, right? So I would kind of start the conversation with making some assumptions about, or maybe challenging some assumptions about the state and kind of criminality and the issue of kind of citizen, alien, non-citizen, whatever, as actually is not one of goodwill on behalf of the state, right? So to me, I think about the issue that was raised in terms of the 14th Amendment and the quote, and I'm no like legal scholar, but the question of, persons that, in the 1860s, there was a very clear assumption about who was also not really persons, right? Like, even despite, you know, the supposed way in which the 13th and 14th Amendment kind of abolished slavery and opened up the possibility of citizenship for blacks, you know, one could argue, well, as we see, certainly 30 years from that, that was a no longer even close to being a foregone conclusion. So, you know, I would kind of name those things, and I also think that the question of documents, I think, particular to black folks in America, actually becomes a mechanism of policing and surveillance, right? So it's not so. I think there's sometimes, I think, in immigration conversations around immigration, there's an assumption that like having documents actually gives one access to freedom, when actually those documents can actually be used, or even the different kinds of markers of citizenship, if you will, become markers for kind of increased policing and control. One example I would use, so you know, we know here in New York City about the stop and frisk laws, right? And even despite, this will show you kind of the insincerity of the state, right? So last year, you know, several organizations have been advocating for, you know, the city to drop its, to drop the stop and frisk process where they would make folks take, you know, pull into their pockets, right? And so then, in that case, if they had any kind of, you know, little bit of weed or whatever on them, it was then in public view, and that would make them a target for arrest. So some people saw that as a great victory, and in some respects, you could argue it was from a policy perspective. But 2 weeks ago, we just saw that actually the stop and frisk numbers from last year were higher than they've ever been. Right, so to me, that is to say that, okay, so and so we think about that, particularly targeting young black and Latino, and particularly, and also I just will tell you my kind of own politics in New York City, that like the you know, because the Latino populations are Puerto Rican, Dominican, Cuban, or whatever, which also are largely black, right? That even that category, right, doesn't like escape kind of blackness within it. So that we often think about that in terms of like, you know, kind of poor black Latino men in communities around New York City in the stop and frisk law. But you often hear reports from even black men who look kind of or appear to be sort of more middle class and with income, that actually them driving a nice car, right, or some other marker of their kind of upper class status, because like, why are you in this neighborhood? Why are you in this car, right? So it's like those things don't actually like, so that's to say that like, you don't escape those things necessarily, that actually just blackness becomes an actual marker for policing and surveillance, and through which even black immigrants get targeted under. And I haven't looked at the data in probably 4 or 5 years, but I certainly know that in the recent years, when you looked at deportations in the U.S., the vast majority of deportations were happening to Mexican folks, right? And right, but when you looked at the issue of who was being deported under criminal deportation procedures, Jamaica, Dominican Republic, you know, Trinidad, you know, most often, you know, black folks in black countries. So it says something about kind of blackness and criminality, which is to say, non-person, non-citizen, person able to participate, right, in citizenship, just whether one has actual papers or not. But the same mechanisms are at work. Backing up a little bit, so I'll talk a little bit about, I guess another kind of, you know, example of where these things also sort of come together. So, you know, we see some of the legislation that has, you know, clearly targeted you know, immigrants in terms of blocking them from being able to access different kinds of, you know, public benefits, right? It's often used the example of a few years ago, the state of Alabama passed this really fucked up legislation to require, to make the argument in Alabama's state legislature was, you know, to prevent, you know, quote unquote, illegals from being able to access Medicaid, Medicare welfare within the state. But what we also saw was after those policies passed, like 4,000 black women in the state of Alabama were kicked off of welfare instantaneously, right? Because there's also this assumption that black people even have documentation, right? Like, you know, they're like actually, you know, I mean, even if you just think about particularly the South, that we didn't even really fully operationalize birth certificates of black people until the, like, 1970s, right? And I was born in 74. So there's a level, and then and certainly with, thank you, with massive imprisonment, with high rates of homelessness, that was a new report that came out today that included that, you know, black people disproportionately homeless, you know, in the U.S., whatever, are also ways in which people just aren't able to kind of maintain documents, or not having documents puts one in positions to be homeless, to be unemployed, to be so on and so forth, right, in prison. So for me, I think... I think where there's possibility is that if the kind of immigrant rights movement is able to disavow itself of some of these kinds of, I feel like the assumptions of goodwill by the state, I think of assuming that having documents actually buys everybody who has them access to citizenship and personhood, and those kinds of things. And if we just figure out a different frame of a conversation that really attacks the prison industrial complex and the ways in which it manifests, there might actually be a potential for a kind of a politics that has real kind of integrity where coalition is concerned. Because the last thing I'll say is I often feel like what I hear in these kind of conversations with African Americans, particularly black folks and immigrants, it's like they just, like, often just want black people to not, like, have any critique of the immigration stuff and want, you know, like, or no questions about even some of the worker centers, quite frankly, as I see less questions about, like, so what does it actually mean that, you know, that there's massive unemployment of black people in American cities, period, right? That, like, you know, I get the issues around, you know, kind of labor and exploitation, but what does it mean when you have cities where half the black population cannot work, right? And what is that, like, and I understand the mechanisms through which, like, black people become the less kind of preferred pools of labor and what that actually means, but can we have a conversation about, like, what immigration actually means in that context, right? And that it actually, you know, has some impact. So to me, like, I feel like those are some of the intersections and ways in which I construct the conversation. Thank you.
Lillian.
Bueno, ya mis compañeros ya nos ilustraron bastante con respecto a este tema.
My colleagues have illustrated a lot to me talk about this topic.
Lo que podría decir es que nosotros fomentamos un movimiento transformativo de justicia social.
What I want to say is that we're trying to do a movement that's transforming, or a social justice movement that transforms.
Con una base comunitaria fuerte.
With a strong community base.
Con nuestros aliados en la comunidad.
Working with allies in our community.
Para que nos apoyen con campañas pidiendo, digamos, una reforma migratoria comprensiva.
So that those allies can help us in campaigns asking for a comprehensive change in immigration law.
Y también fomentando a nuestros miembros que son ciudadanos.
And also to help our members that are citizens.
Que voten para hacer la diferencia, porque a veces también se abstienen, dicen, de todas maneras en el gobierno va a ser lo mismo. siempre nos van a seguir molestando.
And we want to ask those people to vote and to try to make a difference, because sometimes we say, oh, the government's just going to do the same thing.
En nuestra ciudad hemos hecho alianzas en este tema con la policía y con el alcalde.
In this city, in our city, actually, we've made alliances with the police and also with the mayor.
Porque en el pasado, cuando llega ICE a tocar una puerta y las personas ven a la policía, sienten más temor y abren las puertas.
Because in the past, when a person would, someone from ICE would come and knock on a door, and someone would see a policeman, they would be scared and they would open the door.
Entonces ahora tenemos el compromiso del alcalde de no colaborar con ICE para que los acompañe, les dé protección para ir a las casas.
Now we have the commitment from the mayor that they're no longer going to collaborate with ICE and accompany them and protect them when they go to the homes.
E invitamos también a la policía para que llegue a nuestra organización y tener un poco de educación para nuestros miembros.
We also invite the police to come and into our organization and educate the members some.
Con respecto a qué hacer en un momento que la persona pueda ser arrestada y qué no hacer, especialmente con los jornaleros, que a veces se hacen, digamos, rompen las reglas que tal vez la policía ha puesto. Y con ese pretexto a veces pueden ser arrestados.
So they come and they educate us about what to do if you're arrested and also what not to do, especially with the day workers that sometimes unknowingly break the law, the laws that have been put in place, and get in trouble for that.
Pero que tengamos también estas alianzas con la policía en ese sentido, también educamos a nuestros miembros para que no tengan miedo de denunciar en un caso de que realmente la policía también tenga abusos con ellos.
And even though we have this alliance with the police, that we're also educating our members to not be afraid to, if they are ever in a situation where they're abused by the police or there's something that's not done legally, to renounce that and to speak against that.
Y abogados especialistas en este tema de leyes migratorias, para que pues nos motiven a no firmar, a no tener el miedo de decir no, no firmo esos papeles cuando están detenidos.
We also have immigration lawyers that come in and motivate our members to not be afraid to not sign papers when if they are ever detained, that they have that right not to do that.
Y también estamos haciendo campañas como por ejemplo contra Wells Fargo, para decirle que no invierta más dinero en hacer estos centros de detención, ¿verdad? Que a veces se detienen a nuestra gente por su color y es para llenar un espacio y mantener estas riquezas.
We also have a campaign against Wells Fargo to try to get them to stop investing in detention centers. A lot of times our people are detained because of their color, and it's just to fill a space and to keep rich these people who are investing in this.
Y tratar que nuestra comunidad, ¿verdad?, sea un poco más comprensiva con nuestros trabajadores. Tratamos de llevar charlas a las iglesias donde está la comunidad americana.
We also try to go around to the community around us to help them be more understanding with our workers. We've gone to churches where there are American people and try to share with them.
Para que no nos juzguen por nuestro color, sino que estamos aquí para trabajar, para hacer de esta nación una nación más grande, y que no nos conviertan en criminales sin ser criminales, solo porque pues nos ven el color de la piel.
We ask them not to judge our color, please let them know that we're just here to work to make this a bigger nation, and not to convert us into criminals if we haven't done anything to be criminals.
Y que todos los seres humanos somos iguales.
and that all human beings were all equal.
Thank you.
So, because I'm a lawyer, I'm just going to talk about this from the perspective of my clients and my daily, I guess. A lot of the people, like all people, a lot of the trans people I work with, like all people, are forced to migrate to the United States because of globalization, privatization, depletion of resources, lack of jobs, all of these things that, you know, we know forced migration for all people all over the world. And then also for trans people, transgender people we know experience really, really deep systemic discrimination by like all aspects of their life. So in their families, in trying to get a job, in trying to access education, trying to access healthcare, things like that. So there's sort of like an added reason to flee your upbringing in addition to globalization, right? And then on top of that, there's like the myth of the United States being like safer or a place where people can better express their gender identity without violence, even though we know that's not really true. It's still a really big construction of the global socioeconomic safety sphere or something. So a lot of transgender people migrate to the United States and then are not able to access traditional or any forms of immigration or a green card, temporary status, any kind of status. And I think part of that is just the ways that May was describing how like the formation of immigration being one that is centered really on family unification and work, right? Productivity, class and class, race, family unity. And so for a lot of trans, most trans people have no family in the United States, or if they do, a lot of their families are not willing to sponsor them in traditional ways. And, I mean, I've had clients who have had their had a mother or parent have a petition already filed with immigration to sponsor their child, who then transitioned, and then they pull the petition out from immigration because they no longer want to sponsor their child. And then also employment. We know employment immigration is a pretty narrow area anyways, more and more narrowing, but especially challenging for trans people who are facing discrimination all the time, right? I would say most of my clients are either undocumented or have some kind of different immigration status, like asylum or a T visa, trafficking visa for people who are forced into trafficking, or a U visa for people who are survivors of criminal acts, which is actually really common for my clients. I think that Kenya did a really good job of laying out the ways in which people are profiled on the basis of race, right? Like, race is a real factor for local law enforcement to target people, criminalize people, and punish people. And I would just add to that gender expression and sexuality are both added vectors for police profiling of people. And for most of the people I work with are people of color, also transgender, gender nonconforming, or intersex, are also people who are living in poverty, which is another vector of police profiling. Are HIV positive, are perceived as immigrants because of the color of their skin, or are homeless, right? All of these things are working together for police to target them. Some of my clients have a saying which is like taken from Driving While Black. I love that one. Driving While Black. And they say, like, you know, I was picked up, Pooja, because I'm walking while trans, which is like a thing that we see as real happening all the time. And what they mean is to say that trans women, for the most part, or trans women of color in particular, are profiled as doing sex work, and whether they're doing sex work or not doing sex work, and are charged with loitering for the purposes of prostitution. And so, does that make sense? They're all these things work together. Right? So then, in 1996, President Clinton passed all these terrible, terrible immigration laws that, I mean, it was already really pretty terrible, and this policing stuff was going on in really deep, horrible ways, building the prison industrial complex anyways, but under President Clinton passed that IRA Act, and if somebody can help me with the, maybe we don't need to say the whole lot.
Individual responsibility and accountability.
Act?
Yeah. Immigration Reform
Act. And the Anti-Death Penalty Act.
Anti-terrorism and effective death penalty.
Oh, yeah, yeah, terrorism. which are really terrible things that passed in 96 under President Clinton, and adding to the class of deportable criminal convictions for immigrants, right? So this doesn't apply to people who are undocumented, but it does apply because they have no status anyways, so they're deportable. But for people who have any kind of temporary status, so even asylees, having two crimes of moral turpitude, which is really like not defined in immigration law, but it's loosely like quality of life crime, which is what like Bloomberg's term is for the policing of like homeless people or people who are profiled for doing sex work or people who are perceived to be doing drug dealing, things like that. All of those things are moral turpitudes, like jumping a turnstile, like things that really affect poor people in deep ways. Transgender people in particular, are often wrongly charged with different kinds of sex crimes, like are in domestic violence situations, often are the survivor of domestic violence, call the police, and the police have no idea what to do, so they end up arresting everybody, and then the person ends up being titled as a sex offender. So all of those charges are included in moral turpitude, and then also having one aggravated felony as grounds for deportation. So like really, really expanding the grounds for deportation, which in severe ways affects people who are living in poverty, but especially people who are living at like the intersection of all of these different vectors of identity. And then after September 11th, there were all of these new laws added or passed that increased the power of police local law enforcement to enforce federal immigration law, which has traditionally been separated, even though not really that much. But those are also really problematic because they're relying on this really unjust criminal punishment system that profiles people on the basis of all of these different identity grounds and for being poor, and relying on that unjust system to enforce another totally unjust system of immigration, right? So all these laws, like 287G was passed into the Patriot Act, requires a county to sign a memorandum of understanding with ICE that they will enforce federal immigration law. We don't have that in New York City just at the moment, but it doesn't matter because we have other things. And then also, like, the criminal alien program was also passed post-September 11th, which allows immigration officers to actually hang out at prisons and jails and ask people their immigration status and whether they expect it to happen or not, or know any of the consequences of it, and then end up in immigration detention as a result if they answer something wrongly. Like some of my clients will be at Rikers and then asked by an immigration official if they've ever engaged in sex work, which is like really a broad question and maybe happened in their home country. Maybe they were never arrested for it and they answer yes because they're scared, and then they end up in immigration detention. And then secure communities, which I feel like people talked about, and also the new indefinite detention law that Obama just passed, which is like all kinds of scary. And so I think that I would just end by saying that, you know, that all of these systems interact in such deep overlapping ways on the daily for people that I work with. So it's like really common that I see a client come into my office who is undocumented, been recently arrested, and then as a result have an immigration hold, so they have like an ankle bracelet or whatever, and they're under the state's custody and they're facing removal proceedings, which is really terrifying, and they're going to go home to their home country and face their parents who want to kill them or something. So I'll just end there.
Clearly, within the historical, the criminal legal system or the criminal justice system for citizens and non-citizens alike, and then within the immigration system. And so it's absolutely, it's been historically in this country this notion of who's acceptable and who should be expelled, right? It's part of the fabric of the foundation of this country. And I think the particular challenge we face now, every moment has its challenges, is this so-called notion of the rule of law. Right? And so the laws are so screwed up, yet that's not important because you basically broke the law. That was your fault. It doesn't matter if it was last month, 2 years ago, 40 years ago, right? We basically jacked up the laws that any interaction with the criminal justice system for someone who's a non-citizen, almost anyone, not to exaggerate, is considered an aggravated felony, right? So there's certain things that are considered worse than anything else. Firearm possession, like you could have one, you know, one firearm, or you could be selling a crate of them. It's still the same consequence in the law, right? You can have possession of cocaine for personal use, or you could be selling a kilo. It's still the same situation in terms of what's considered an aggravated felony, right? And so I feel like in our position, we fight for anyone's right regardless of what your conviction was. That's not our issue, right? But I just point this out to say that it seems so logical, right? Well, he's an aggravated felon, right? But then, you know, that built upon his, you know, decades and decades and decades of, you know, the kind of notions of zero tolerance, who's acceptable, who's not, you know, mass incarceration, three strikes. Like, it all just follows a logic, right, where particular communities, particularly brown and black communities, are getting, you know, whether it's you're incarcerated here or expelled outside of this country. And so, I mean, just in terms of this, like, pre-9/11, post-9/11 landscape, I mean, one thing that I think is really interesting and challenging to get our heads around is, like, all these building blocks were laid out before 9/11, right? 9/11 just gave the government the opportunity to, like, blow all this stuff out because it's all about national security now, no matter what it is, right? So do people know about what former Attorney General Ashcroft said about Haiti post 9/11. You remember this great, great thing that came out? Okay. So what has been the history of the U.S. treatment of Haitian refugees? Not good, but bad. Bad, right? Really bad, right? And so one of the things that happened is, like, another aspect of it is treating people who have as asylees, right, as, you know, going into a detention facility. Whereas, you know, decades prior, that wasn't the practice, right? I'm not saying this country was perfect, but I'm just trying to make a point that things are getting worse. But in particular with the Haitian refugees, one of the things Ashcroft said was, you know, when there was the whole crisis with the coup and a lot of people were needing to get out of Haiti, he said, you know, we have evidence that people from Pakistan and Palestine are using Haiti as a launching pad. Right? Don't need to say anymore. And so, therefore, we're not going to let any Haitians in. Okay? And, like, I can't remember the statistics, but maybe, like, 3 people from Haiti received asylum during this period out of thousands of people. It's disgusting, right? So, and it's like the ability to push the agenda without any more safeguards is, I think, really what happened in 9/11. And, you know, and we all hear, we know a lot about what's happening now with NYPD in the Muslim community, what happened, you know, in terms of people from particular countries with, you know, special registration and rounding up people. But we have to be clear, this is something that's affecting, you know, all peoples, right? All non-citizens and citizens alike. And so, you know, one of the features of post 9/11, which has manifested in this program that keeps getting referenced, secure communities. Does everyone know what secure communities is? No. Okay, so what it is it's a fingerprinting program. Once you get booked at the police, your fingerprints always almost get sent to the FBI. That's been practiced for decades. Now with secure communities, it gets sent through the FBI to DHS. DHS is going to talk to the FBI, say, do we have a match here? Then they're going to contact the police office saying, please hold that person. This is Immigration Customs Enforcement, because we want to question them to see if they're deportable, right? And so, you know, following up on who just said 287G, that's the whole thing we hear about Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, where cops are actually deputized to be immigration agents. But secure communities is the fix for all the critique that 287G got, because now it's a technological program. Oh, and, you know, they honestly say this, there's no racial profiling because everybody's fingerprinted, right? That's what ICE, that's in their propaganda. And so, you know, the challenge that we face now, so secure communities is just one piece of a massive surveillance infrastructure that the FBI is setting up, right? Anyone who has a passport, if you don't have a new one, if you have a new one, it has a little chip in there, right? So they'll know where you are at any point in time.
right? There's anyone with a visa, there's a little chip in there. So you're in a bus with a visa, you go by like Easy Pass, they'll know, oh, you know, this person's on the bus. Like, but all this stuff is happening, and there's very little that we're able to do to stop it, right? So that's, I think, the real challenge. And so kind of back to this now, this era of deportation is just one form of social control. I'm very clear. It's not like it's a big issue. It's not the only one. But it's one that's being exercised in tremendous force right now, right? And really at this convergence of the criminal, where, you know, the criminal justice system employing the police on all levels to be immigration agents, whether it's technologically, whether it's deputizing them, and also, you know, the impact on communities. I used to work in Washington Heights, right? One of these communities was heavily Dominican, heavily targeted by the war on drugs, right? And every day I would have 5 to 10 people come in. Here's my, you know, my disposition, my rap sheet. I want to get a, you know, renew my green card. What can I do? Well, you can't really do anything unless you're ready to go into deportation proceedings, right? And so, but this happened 25 years ago. What does, you know, it doesn't matter. This happened 1 year ago. It was only this, it was only that. And then, oh, I have a friend, blah, blah, blah. But, like, this is what, this is the thing that I think, you know, ICE refers to the police as their force multiplier, right? Secure communities is the force multiplier. And now we can access everywhere. So just kind of coming back to this thing where I just want to move this conversation into, I think, you know, one of the challenges clearly within the immigrant rights movement is it's not really fighting the war in terms of the fight for the right of all immigrants, right? And I think, you know, since 1984 when Reagan did his amnesty, and that's when it was all laid out, enforcement first, then amnesty, right? In 84 they got amnesty, right? And now it's basically become enforcement first, right? Well, we'll secure the border. Let's get rid of all those criminal aliens. You know, we'll get the guest worker program in. We'll make sure that, whatever, on and on. You know, but now we're in a moment of enforcement only. And I think the challenge that we face is this whole, when people talk about comprehensive immigration reform, that was how it was laid out. It's no different than life than we're living now, except that there's no way we're going to get past legalization anytime soon. Because all the bargaining chips are gone, right? So the Democrats banked on this thing saying, we'll give you the border enforcement, we'll give you mass deportation if you just give us that path to citizenship. You know, these are the good immigrants that we're trying to save versus the bad ones. And it just, it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work as a moral argument, it doesn't work in terms of politics, right? And I think Obama has put us in a very challenging situation now, where he's implemented all the negative sides of comprehensive immigration reform administratively, and what are we left with now? Right? A million people deported under his watch. This whole notion of the criminal alien is so deeply entrenched now at all levels. Like, it's really incredible. And so I can go on and on about that. Let me just make sure I just made one more point about this. I mean, I just do think that this one thing, that it's like a real challenge in terms of when we talk about how is it then that we build to the next level, right? You think about before, you know, your example of stop and frisk. Like, how is it that we're going to get the NYPD, you know, to reform their practices in any meaningful way, right? How is it that we're going to get the federal government to change their policies in any meaningful way? You know, we did, I will say this, and before I forget, I did work very heavily on the Secure Communities campaign, and one thing that we did do is we did get the governor of the state of New York to say no to Secure Communities. And, you know, even though it was an imperfect victory in the sense of the FBI said, we don't care what you want to do, it was a victory, right? And I think that we have to say, you know, that's something Cuomo did that was at some level recognizing that it's not okay, you know, for police to be operating this capacity. So I know it's time to wrap up. But, I mean, I hope that we can engage in this conversation in terms of this notion of, you know, the real problematics of the banner of we are not the criminals here.
Thank you all. Michelle had to leave, so I'm here to help us go through. I'm Patricia Clough, and I'm from sociology here at Queens College, and also part of the police seminar. And thank our panels. Panelists, maybe you'd like to have one more round of a few moments just to close up, hearing what others said, if you'd like to make one more comment so that we can then open up to the audience, because There's so much knowledge up here, and I know the questions to you will be really important. So maybe take 1 second each.
But maybe just one more
a minute, a
word each, given what others have said on the panel. And then I'll come back and stop you, and we'll open up to the audience.
I've learned a lot from my co-panelists, and I really appreciate all the work that you guys are doing. I just want to make one comment. I mean, it's not to disagree with anybody at all, but I think what is important for us to understand is that this kind of, even with this massive kind of surveillance and arrest, detention, and deportation going on, it's actually still a minority of the immigrant population, but it has its own multiplier effect in terms of the kind of, you know, I guess you could call it a chill effect, right, on what people, how safe people feel or what they think they can do. And I think what's striking to me is that the 1996 laws, the IRA-IRA and the other one, is that they were punitive in nature. Right, and that these laws were passed by Congress right on the heels of another immigration law that Congress passed in 1990, which raised the ceiling on legal immigration by 40%. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you had in the middle of an economic boom and a big draw for labor, especially immigrant labor, by business, by the service industries, by employers who wanted cheap labor, but also malleable labor and labor that wouldn't fight back. So you have on the one hand a raising of the ceiling on legal migration, and anytime you know, legal and illegal migration happen together, right? It's not like one or the other. They happen in tandem. So you have on the one hand an economic expansion and boom, right, from the 80s and 90s, which led business to ask Congress for an increase in legal migration. Right, so then you have an increase in both legal and unauthorized migration. And at the same time, you have a series of laws that can only be understood as punitive in nature, absolutely punitive. So what this says is, we want you to come and work, but if you slip up the tiniest little bit, you're out. Right, and I think, you know, there have been studies done that show that employers call ICE when there is a union drive. Right. I mean, employers don't look at the fake Social Security cards. They hire who they want to hire, right? And then all of a sudden they check their records and find evidence of fraudulent documentation when the workers are attempting to get a higher wage or to bring in a union or something like this. So it's not merely a question of surveillance and policing and detention, but it's also connected to a whole political economy of a kind of labor force without rights that can be thrown out at a moment's notice. And I think, you know, this has had a great effect in terms of immigrant labor. I mean, I think some of the things that we were hearing from Lillian about people who are stopped and questioned and they don't know why they're being questioned, this is what's happening everywhere. And it has a real kind of multiplier effect in the community beyond people who may or may not be a so-called criminal alien.
I think I should have probably started this way, but I think your presentation made me think in this construct that, you know, really, much in the same ways that, you know, we've heard about the kind of immigration system kind of moving to a system that's, you know, even more and more about kind of punitive. I mean, in many ways, the U.S. kind of social welfare state has done the same thing. So I think about the law, the IRA bill passed in 96, actually passed at the same time as the Welfare Reform Act, which basically did the same, I mean, or had similar kinds of impact, particularly for you know, low-income women in the U.S., and so the state of and some of the ways that played out, right, specifically were it allowed the states to make determinations about if you had been convicted of a felony drug offense, the state could then decide whether those folks were able to get welfare or not, right, and nearly all the southern states since that time have permanent bans on being able to access welfare if you were convicted of any kind of felony drug use. It also made kind of punitive relationship or an adversarial relationship between, you know, mothers and biological fathers, right, quote unquote, so that parents, in order to get welfare, you have to identify a biological father on a birth certificate so that the state can go after that person for, child support. And if they get arrested in any other situation, that's in the system, so that there are these linkages between the social welfare state and the police state are one and the same, right? From my vantage point doing, HIV specific work and a lot of kind of health stuff broadly. So there's been more and more pushes from the Centers for Disease Control that's moved through the states this happened about 10 years ago instead of having anonymous HIV tests to go to a confidential test, right? Which basically means that states then have to report names of who actually has HIV. And then the city of New York has actually done this whole project with diabetes, which they're also trying to do with HIV, and they do in some respects with people who are HIV positive, where they can monitor as the state your sort of progress with diabetes and have case managers show up at your house and find out why you haven't been to your doctor or, you know, all this stuff to kind of get you back into care. And similarly, in terms of HIV, people's, case managers show up, at their, houses or whatever, so on and so forth. So all that to say, and then people then get brought into different kinds of criminal cases as a result of that, but that the actual experience of that is the same, right? So it's not as though people experience those systems as benevolent. They experience it as the same as they do NYPD, right? And that's an argument I'm trying to make the public health people understand. That's another story. So why people are ducking and diving, y'all. So, to name that, the social welfare state in many ways that people think of as benevolent or the thing that sort of gives like access to quote unquote citizens all these different benefits has actually just another mechanism through which people get police surveilled and sorted through the, the prison system.
Sí, me gustaría nada más agregar que estas leyes lo que hacen es un gran impacto en nuestra comunidad, porque la separación de familias trae pues problemas de salud física y mental a los jóvenes y a los adultos también, ¿verdad?
I'd also like to add that these laws have a great impact on our people, the separation of families, the physical and the psychological impact on the youth and also the adults.
Y en la comunidad, porque los empleadores están abusando más al conocer que las personas tienen miedo por todas estas leyes migratorias, tienen miedo a denunciar. Las mujeres en su trabajo están siendo golpeadas, incluso violadas por los mismos empleadores. Y saben que tienen miedo ir a la policía porque a veces al final dicen, bueno, estabas en la casa del empleador. Eso fue lo que unas policías le dijeron a una mujer. Estabas en la casa del empleador y ese es su derecho. Y realmente yo creo que nadie tiene derecho a usar la violencia en contra de ninguna persona. No podemos aceptar la violencia venga de donde venga. Tenemos que decir no.
Also, the employers are using this fear to be able to abuse people more. They know that people are free to speak out and to report, so they are beating women, they are even raping them. Mm-hmm. So they know they're afraid to report it to the police. And one woman was asked by the police, were you in their house when it happened? Well, then that was their right, but I don't think anyone has a right to use violence against anyone.
Esa es una amenaza constante sobre los trabajadores. Eres ilegal, no tienes derecho a nada. Y eso es lo que tratamos de que se sientan que sí tienen derecho primero como seres humanos, como trabajadores en este país, a pesar de que hay leyes bien fuertes, pero si estamos dando un servicio nos tienen que respetar como trabajadores.
And so this is a constant threat that they face, and they say, you know, you're illegal, well then you have no rights. But we want them to understand that they still have rights as human beings and as workers, and as workers in this country, even despite a lot of the laws, they do have rights to be treated correctly.
Nosotros en Long Island estamos peleando una ordenanza local que prohíba que los jornaleros se paren en las esquinas a pedir trabajo, pero ha querido la suerte que una corte diga que sí tienen derecho a pararse en cualquier lugar para poder pedir trabajo, así que esperamos poder votar esa ordenanza ya con esto que dijo la corte.
In Long Island, we're working against the local ordinance that prohibits day workers from standing on the corners and asking for work, but we've been lucky that there's a court in the U.S. that has said that yes, the workers have a right to stand on the corners, so we're hoping to be able to get rid of this local ordinance.
Así que sí, el impacto es bien fuerte en nuestra comunidad.
So yes, the impact of these laws is really strong in our communities.
Thank you. I guess I just want to end by saying a little bit about the like narrative of the good immigrant versus the bad immigrant, and then also off of what you were saying about access to safety generally. And I think I've been thinking about this so much in knowing that the work that I do, the immigrants that I work with are never like the good immigrants, right? They're always framed as the bad immigrants. But then also how the narrative against secure communities, or the most successful narrative, was so much relied on like domestic violence survivors who were afraid to call the police because they were undocumented, right? And so they didn't want to be fingerprinted or punished for that, and how that is inherently, right, that relies on a system that we know is not safe, the criminal injustice punishment system, but then also that is the strongest argument, and it's real that people need safety. And so, like, what does that mean? And I don't have any answers. I don't know. And I think about it in relationship a lot to just, like, working in a broader LGBT movement and being an advocate for trans people specifically. And also, and similarly, knowing that trans people of color who are living in poverty, who are the people I work with, are never, like, the model LGBT person to put forward, right? But instead it's like a white, like affluent gay man who wants to get married or something like that is like the perfect like model, and how that's really problematic too. And just what does that mean? I don't know if this is really unclear, but then I've also sort of been tying it to thinking about laws, like really overtly racist laws, like Arizona's SB 1070 and the copycat laws that have like been proposed and passed in Georgia and Alabama, mm-hmm. And how they've received so much national attention as being so racist and so outrageous and so over the top, and even like President Obama has critiqued them and urged the Department of Justice to challenge the Arizona law, but at the same time, like, is passing similar federal legislation in the name of national security, right? And like, what does that mean, and how is that working to further like the FBI agenda while simultaneously making like individual states look really racist or problematic or outrageous? And I know those are really different like threads of thoughts, but those are all just things I've been thinking about.
Okay, I guess just a lot of things to talk about. No, I guess I just want to end on the one point about the Department of Homeland Security, only because it has so much power now. It's a relatively new agency, and it's humongous, right? So it's something that there's no accountability. I mean, what is accountability? We don't have accountability over anybody. But I just wanted to kind of raise this just to think about the logic that's created by funding, right? So does everyone know there's a quota for deportation now, right? It's a quota that's set on a budget. Napolitano has said we can only afford to deport 400,000 people a year. That's why we're doing what we're doing, right? And so, you know, within the government, there's a lot of tension. Like, I do feel like, obviously, they want certain people to stay here and work here. We want to give visas to these kind of people. We want to allow these kind of undocumented people to be able to have a path to citizenship. But then for those who fall off, you know, because you've been, you know, whether falsely or rightfully convicted of a crime, you know, then you're no longer there, right? You know, there's certain types of immigrants that are invisible in the national conversation, right? Like, you know, Dominicans, Haitians, Jamaicans. When you go to Rikers, you know, these are a lot of the immigrant populations that we're talking to, right? And so I feel like just, you know, this challenge of how to approach as an organizer, thinking about what we face. So we're talking about the FBI, we're talking about DHS, we're talking about Obama, who clearly many people hoped would be an ally, right? We're talking about the tension raised by people like Kris Kobach and his whole agenda with Arizona, Alabama, Georgia, wherever, you know, a right wing that has the dominance of, you know who Kris Kobach is? Okay, he's an attorney. I can't remember where he used to work, but he's basically the brainchild behind all this right-wing, like the SB 1070 bill. He's the advisor now to Mitt Romney on his immigration platform, and he's someone who's actually very creative in identifying the legal possibilities, whether they're actually can be held up in a court of law or not, it doesn't matter. But kind of capturing a very right-wing, racist, anti-immigrant discourse and turning it into a law. I'm probably doing a very bad job of describing who he is, but that's who he is. He's a scary man, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think that the point is, like, yeah, so there are these right-wing bills at SB 1070, but the U.S. government for, you know, a long time has been giving a lot of police in Arizona the right to police immigrants, right? So what the hell do you expect is going to happen if Joe Arpaio? Right, when you give them those kind of powers. And so these are the kinds of things that, you know, we have to kind of bring up into the conversation, but also recognizing that, you know, the opponents we face, as always, are really, what's the word, formidable?
Thank you so much, Pam. I'm sure there are many questions, so let's see some hands. Yes.
I have a question. I think in early January, there were all these news reports out of Alabama about the fact that the Department of Agriculture and Industries noticed that they didn't have enough people to be agricultural workers due to their terrible immigration law and people choosing to leave the state as opposed to being deported from the state. And so they're replacing, or they're thinking of replacing all of this needed work with prison labor. Ever since reading this and reading articles that have been debating this, it's just created, I was wondering if anyone on the panel could talk about the intersection of the state, both the state and the state, identifying sort of disposable populations, or I've been struggling with how to think about it, and I wonder if anyone could add better thoughts to it than I have.
Just to quickly say, I mean, I'm aware of it. I'm not fully versed, but I've seen that has been a discussion, and I'm not shocked. I mean, I've driven through Alabama a number of times, and there's no Alabama, Arkansas, the number of states I can name in the South where you still see, you know, hundreds of black people picking cotton under armed guard, right? Like, I mean, that's not new nor... You know, whatever. So to me, that's the legacy of like being in the post-slave era, right? Like, you know, that is kind of a constant, you know, sort of situation that I feel like, you know, black folks find ourselves as like valuable only as captive labor. Right, you know what I mean? And not to suggest that, like, kind of chattel slavery was only about labor and economics. I think that's often said too much, and I think that's false. But we see that kind of, that show up all the time. I mean, like, all the time. Every 10 years, another state decides they're going to go back to a chain gang. I mean, it's not new, so it's not surprising to me that that is also the solution.
Can I just add one thing? I mean, I don't know, I'm not familiar so much with that particular proposal, but I feel like, you know, when we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, like, I think this notion of, like, this country's always been defined, like I said, of who's allowed to be here, who's desirable, and who isn't, right? And I think one of the things that is going to happen is, you know, with these programs like E-Verify that can check people's social security number across a massive database, is a guest worker program, right? So, like, so much of the Southwest, right, was that's the status that they want for migrant labor. I mean, I think a lot of agricultural companies are fine with undocumented workers, right, for reasons that you mentioned of exploitability and all that stuff. But I do feel like if, you know, I don't know enough about prison labor to know how that will play, but I imagine that would be one piece of it, but also the guest worker program will, then it will have the much more, like, an argument to institute something that the government's been wanting to expand for a while. Yes.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Pooja and Ms. Wynn. One of the things I think about a lot is this whole, you know, these dichotomies that occur within immigration advocacy and queer advocacy around the good, bad immigrant thing and this whole idea of comprehensive immigration reform. And I think one of the things that, you know, in working in immigration advocacy and that being my research, one of the things that's sort of been a struggle is seeing, you know, just the different levels of immigration advocacy organizing that occurs, where a lot of compromises are made, where particularly around language, where, like, this good immigrant, bad immigrant dichotomy is used, and where we're constantly, like, you know, making these compromises. Like, for example, we're asking to stop deportation of certain immigrants, then we get prosecutorial discretion, and, like, these little things that we get every single time. And I guess one of the questions that I have is, how do you think that, you know, in terms of coalition building and just real radical immigration advocacy and just queer immigration advocacy, can we really get to the level where we're not making those compromises and we're actually asking for policy changes that actually impact communities in a way that isn't, you know, compromising certain communities over others?
Okay. Well, I only want to start, not because I like talking a lot, but it's mostly I'm very passionate about these issues. But in particular, I wanted to just talk about the Secure Communities campaign and how it was run nationwide and how we chose to fight it here. And, you know, I think when Secure Communities came about, it definitely felt kind of on a national level. The framework was, you know, the program is catching the wrong people, right? It's catching people with minor offenses, traffic violations, or innocent people. And when we found out that New York had signed the agreement to participate in this, we quickly put together our coalition. We spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the unity in our campaign is we're going to be fighting for the rights of all immigrants. So we were very conscious about bringing into the room, you know, different, whether, you know, LGBTQ, DV advocates, labor, traditional immigrant, like people working on both, like, all sides of immigrant rights, you know, those of us who work with people with convictions, those who don't, and really forcing this conversation. What does it mean to run a campaign when we're advocating for the rights of all people? It wasn't easy, and it wasn't perfect, and it was constantly trying to push back on the framing, because, again, the framing was national, where the statistics, you know, really helped tell the story. And this is why I think a lot of politicians honestly got behind the campaign against Secure Communities, because a lot of people are getting caught up in it with minor offenses, whatever, and the whole racial profiling thing. But anyway, I'd like to say that we were successful maintaining that, and to the point when we got into negotiations with the governor's office, because the governor was like, well, how about rather than getting rid of the MOA that you guys are asking us to do, getting rid of this agreement to participate, we just decided to draw a line to say that the state would be okay if only people with felonies were getting submitted. And we were like, no, that's not what we're here to do. And I feel like we were only able to do that unified because we had been all fighting together for 5 months, and those of us who did most of the work held that position that we weren't going to compromise. And so I really see that as a victory, because what he did end up doing was suspending the MOA, right? And I think that, and we had an influence on the national conversation, I think, around Secure Communities. So I still feel like, it's really unfortunate, because
the moment was lost. Like, we're so far, every year we get so much further behind, right? And so I feel encouraged that we've shifted the conversation. I feel extremely discouraged that by next year, secure communities will be in almost every county across the country. And so it's just like a constant struggle. But thank you for asking the question.
Yeah, I would just echo that and say constant struggle. And another part of it is just like having these conversations, like saying, you know, like I actually work with people who are low income transgender people of color who are not benefiting from this particular like reform that you're asking for. And I think that can go far, not far. And I think just like thinking strategically about where you want to insert yourself is really important too. And I know that the Celia Rivera Law Project has had like these debates a lot with the broader LGBT, like well-funded, more white organizations, right? And pushing as far as we can push, and then being like, okay, like Medicaid's not your issue. We're gonna go check in with the poverty people, or like thinking about like the prison industrial complex and drawing connections in those movements, you know. And I think both. Like, I think we need to be doing both, like having real conversations and pushing people, and then also realizing like this is not a victory that I want to support, and taking yourself out of it.
Yes.
My question is probably going to shift our focus a little bit, but I was thinking when you were talking about invisible immigrants, and I've been thinking, it started me thinking about the visibility of immigrants, who's invisible, who is visible, and how the whole question of immigrants and criminality is playing in the mediation of ideology in the presidential campaign, the way that criminality and the prison industrial complex is mediated is so ubiquitous and so profound. I mean, we have reality TV prison shows, so I was wondering, in terms of your activism, especially, you know, working in documentary photography, but also representing these people who are made invisible or hypervisible as criminal, how have you thought about any kind of media strategy to combat this?
Well, I can't answer the question directly, but I think what I'm really learning from the other speakers is that in this process of coalition building and building a movement that does not sacrifice some, you know, for the benefit of another group, is the importance of the voices of all of these groups being heard and at the table. So I think that, you know, the best prospects lie when people keep fighting for those things, and the poor trans people of color are telling the others, right? Don't leave me out, right? I'm a person like you. I mean, this is something that has to come and does come from those communities themselves. And I think, you know, we see that the kind of awesome work that the activists and advocates are doing, but they're doing it because the people themselves in those communities are organized and organizing themselves, like the workers or the trans people. And I think, I mean, it's true. I mean, we have so many layers of economic interests, law, you know, decades or hundreds of years of racism that's institutionalized. You know, we're up against really formidable challenges. But what I, you know, one thing I learned in studying the history of immigration reform in the middle part of the 20th century is that when the national origin quotas were overturned, these were the racist quotas that were implemented in the 1920s, the people who drove that reform movement were basically the children of those immigrants who came at the turn of the 20th century. You know, basically white ethnics, you know, American Jews, Italian Americans, Greek Americans, who saw that those quotas were injurious to their communities. So it's not a question of convincing the Southern Democrats or the right wing, because you're not ever going to convince them. You will never convince them. It's a question of the social movements of those communities themselves that begin to change the political calculus in the country. And it's not enough just that they organize. You have to have a lot of other factors like allies, you know, certain economic conditions, you know, certain demographic conditions. But I think it's, you know, really, what's really important for us to just reflect on for a moment is, you know, how Obama won the last election, right? The states that flipped from blue to red, or red to blue, the states that flipped, that had voted for Bush in the last election, that flipped to Democrat, were all states where Latinos were the significant vote. Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Florida, even states like Virginia, North Carolina. The data are there. These are the states where Latinos made a difference. So Latinos are not all undocumented. They're voters. They're voters, right? And they're concentrated in certain states. So I think, you know, you change, things will change, at least on a legislative level, when you have more of this kind of politics in action. I mean, of course, it takes a lot more than that. I mean, I think the kind of grassroots organizing and direct action and, you know, social movement work is also really important. In fact, they all go together. But I think the thing for us to remember is that we're never going to convince the right wing. The point is to get, you know, so what we would say is our people, you know, organize. And I think that, you know, we can see that happening. There's a kind of immigrants' rights movement that's driven by immigrants that is, we didn't see 15 years ago in the same way that we see something now. So I think things look bleak in one sense, and in another sense we could say there's some cause for optimism.
Yes.
I want to thank you all so much for the account. It's a really interesting discussion.
I'll
do my best. I'm from Los Angeles, and I actually work with very low income, homeless, mostly black population in Skid Row. And there, for the past number of years, we've seen the implementation of laws that are actually very similar to secure communities. So, you know, a lot of people had the same response as the secure communities. Sounds like a great thing, safer cities. Who doesn't want a safer city? But, you know, these measures end up looking very similar. So, you know, the safer cities, you know, was essentially a method to surveil extremely vulnerable populations, you know, and just kind of broaden the categories of criminality in order to bring people into the criminal justice system. So in the first couple of years, you know, in a community that's got like less than 50,000 people, there were over 28,000 citations given, most of them for jaywalking. And what would happen is people get arrested for jaywalking, their whole record gets pulled up, and then if they had a ticket for jaywalking before, they didn't pay. If they had some bench warrant out, then they get picked up and brought into the system. And so, you know, because of the high level of vulnerability of this particular population, it's been this testing ground for, you know, federal policies of surveillance. And actually, the National Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative was implemented in Los Angeles under William Bratton when he was chief of police of the LAPD. And, you know, it's been this effort to streamline the interactions between local police, national security agencies, the FBI, the CIA, et cetera, et cetera. So my question, I'm just wondering if anybody on the panel can speak to the fact that these new immigrant laws seem to be built on these systems of surveillance, these structures, like you said, Kenyon, that you know, either enforce movement or produce immobility or create these fluid categories of criminality that we've seen being built in. I mean, essentially, like, you know, you don't have this new system of immigration law, like, unless it's built, you know, in tandem with the criminal, with the prison industrial complex. I know you all spoke to it, but I was just hoping for a little more discussion about that particular relationship.
Can you just reframe your question? Sorry, I had a lot of things. Like, so what particular piece of it, or did you have a colleague?
No.
The tandem piece of it, or just the?
The tandem piece of it. I'm just wondering how people think about
you know, I mean, the struggle on the panel seems to be how you think about these things together, right? And so, you know, there are these discursive differences of good immigrant, bad immigrant. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's like, do we understand these as two separate systems, or do we understand how they grow together? And I'm just wondering.
Right. Okay, gotcha. Okay, so my response to that is, like, yes.
They do so together.
I mean, but I forget whose presentation earlier, but you know, one of the things I was struck by was, you know, how much of even so, like in the post Vietnam, so like the late 70s, you know, in the 80s, when the U.S. was not in, I mean, you know, I say this wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but not in an active war, right, with another nation, right? That the same kind of logics about where warlike language that is normally categorized to sort of target, you know, people in states of war was used to talk about South Central Los Angeles, right? Was used to talk about Harlem, was used to talk about the South Bronx, and justified the kind of relationship that, like, the actual mechanical relationship between local law enforcement and the military, right? So that military units started training local law enforcement's build up of local law enforcement's actual capacities to have tanks, to have these machines. If you live in Crown Heights on Franklin Avenue or in Bed-Stuy on Halsey and Tompkins, where they put these big scaffolding machines, which they're about to build on the Christopher Street Pier, targeting kids, right? So, you know, all of this is military apparatus in local police departments, right? That was built, right, before, you know, 9/11, right? And that infrastructure and those logics and the sort of narratives about being at war with an internal body of people was already in place, right? And so just to suggest that, like, what you're saying is absolutely true, that that then the kind of post 9/11 kind of super consolidation of, you know, kind of police state and in all this kind of rhetoric out of national security, well, the infrastructure was already there. So that the relationships that we now see with local, or that are maybe, I should say, more visible to some people as in operation, have been there since the 80s, right, at least.
Yeah.
And before. I mean, right. Before.
Yeah,
I mean, just kind of building on that, I think that it's one of these interesting things about this whole surveillance thing and how it hooks up with the military is just, you know, the use of, for example, drones. We hear about drones being used on the U.S.-Mexico border, drones being used in Pakistan, Afghanistan, right? You know, one of the initial ways of gathering biometric information were soldiers walking around Afghanistan getting people's fingerprints, and that's being fed into this massive database, right? So this is what it's all about. It's like bringing all these different pieces together. And just one last piece on that whole thing about, you know, the loitering laws and the trespass laws and the building of all these different categories of criminality and infrastructure. It's like the infrastructure's in place. The aggravated felony exists, right? Every time there's any immigration bill, there's more aggravated felonies added on, right? So right now there's an authorization for the Violence Against Women Act. And what's on there is something to make DUI, you know, two TDUIs an aggravated felony. Is it two or three? Three. A DUI is not a deportable offense, right? And so it's
this not a felony either.
Yeah, it's not a felony either, exactly. And so, like, every time you have any authorization, there's more and more stuff that gets put on there. So that's saying you're now an aggravated felony. A CIMT, a crimes involving moral turpitude, the standard gets even, you know, harder for people to stay here. And so I feel like, you know, there's just one last point on this criminalization thing. The way, you know, in this era of criminal alien and this war on terror, you know, they can't possibly catch terrorists, right? So this whole rhetoric has, and even if they could, like the way that they're trying to do it, it's not okay. But just to be clear, but it's not okay. So yeah, I'm just trying to talk to the facts. But you know, the one point I want to end on here is that you know, so we got to get the numbers up. You know, you have Obama and Napolitano saying we're catching the criminals, and so they now a big thing is prosecuting people for immigration violations.
So if you came here and they're charging you with illegal reentry, right? Depending on your circumstance, you're going to get more time in federal prison. But so when you look at the DHS stats now, we're catching all these criminals, right? We got the dangerous drug offenses, which is any drug offense, and we have the people for immigration violations, traffic offenses, you know, and it kind of goes down the line. So it's kind of like back to this good immigrant, bad immigrant. They're always going to figure out how to put more and more people into the bad category. So it's just a losing
formula. Can I add one more depressing note? I think the other part that's grown together is the use of private subcontractors to build and rent detention centers. And this is taken directly out of the page book of the prison system. And once you have private capital involved in investing and building and running these centers, it's very hard to get rid of them because there's, you know, it's a business. So I think that's just another aspect of this. I just want to also add, aggravated felony is not a legal, I mean, it's an administrative term that they made up. It's not, there's no such thing legally as an aggravated felony crime. It's, crimes are, the kind of crimes you're talking about are actually state, determined by states, right? And even what counts for a felony or a misdemeanor in one state may be different in another state. The sentencing may be different from one state to another. Aggravated felony is a fiction, an administrative term that was invented by immigration to group certain crimes, including misdemeanors, together to make them grounds for deportation. So I don't know what would be the two instances of shoplifting. Neither, you know, one, shoplifting is not a felony. Two turnstile jumps is an aggravated felony, right? So two misdemeanors that involve turpitude or theft or larceny of any kind equals an aggravated felony. So it sounds like a really scary kind of aggravated felony, you know, it sounds really scary. It doesn't exist as any kind of actual crime, right? It's an administrative device.
I'm sorry, but I believe we have to come to an end. I'm sure you'll join with me to thank the panelists. It's just